Okay, folks, I think we'll start. What we'll do is Bill and I will keep our introductions quite short, so because everybody has a PowerPoint presentation, and then we can have discussions. If we really overrun, then I would suggest we have the presentations, and if there's not that much time for questions, to leave the questions till later to all the panelists. Anyway, good afternoon and welcome to CSIS. Thank you all for coming. This is actually, I think, a third in the series of events that we've organized, a short series that we put together to look at the challenges to Western investment, Central Eastern Europe. We felt this was a neglected aspect of economic and political development amongst the new NATO and EU members, but one that has serious implications, not only for Western business operations, but for the consolidation of competitive market economies and democratic polities in the region. We plan to develop this over the coming year into maybe a broader series, maybe even a conference, and also to compile a report that could be useful for analysts and business alike. And we're happy this afternoon to have a number of excellent, well-informed speakers. And we decided to divide the agenda into three parts. First of all, a broader overview of the risks and challenges to investing in Central Eastern Europe. Secondly, focusing then a little bit more on judicial reform and corruption in the region. And third but not last, looking a little bit more detail at Russia's growing influence, both particularly over business but also political influence in parts of Central and Eastern Europe, also parts of Europe as a whole, and what this signals for such questions as transparency, competition, and corruption. And we'll conclude, if there's time, by trying to pinpoint a few pointers, for the future, in other words, for future work that we may do that may be useful to U.S. Business and to policymakers. So, Bill, do you want to say a few words before we kick off?
Okay. I'll be very brief also. We're very fortunate to have the speakers that are dealing with three of the key major issues I believe that the private sector has to look at when they're looking at foreign investment. What are the challenges and risks? And basically, now that most of Central Europe has joined the EU or are in that framework, that is a lot of those questions are being settled, and the markets are becoming more standardized and more secure for the foreign investor. But the issues of transparency and corruption are still major problems that the foreign investor has to deal with. The two other issues I'd like to very briefly comment on that sort of keep in mind as we get the presentations this afternoon. One is that for the foreign investor, it is still a competitive environment for the country. If you want to attract foreign investment, you have to be competitive with other opportunities, not only in your region, but around the world, because it is with this global economy that we've heard so much now, globalization, each individual country is, in effect, in competition with all the other countries. And it's more and more a question of, you know, what is our niche? Where can we be competitive? How can the government create an environment that is more attractive than other countries to get foreign investment and to create jobs? And I think a second issue that is still a problem in the region is, I would say, the lack of continuity from one government to the next, because quite often when governments change, the rules change, the people change, and the outgoing government takes their files with them when they leave, and you have to start all over again with the next government. So these are the sorts of things that a lot of the foreign investors have to look at when they're looking at a country as a potential site for foreign investment. So I'll stop there and give it to the experts.
Okay, thank you. These issues for which we are here today. I will discuss Bulgaria and Romania from the viewpoint of political risk. And to this extent, I would like to say in advance a couple of things, sort of a disclaimer. First of all, because I am focusing on this narrow set of issues that are relevant to political risk, I will not focus on other issues on which other speakers will focus. Mostly, I think about corruption and the judiciary. These are extremely relevant issues to the business environment of these two countries, but they're not going to be part of my presentation. Secondly, adopting the viewpoint of political risk, I am adopting the viewpoint basically of foreign investors. So, of course, there are very different perceptions of how countries and environments are, depending whether you are from the country or you are a foreign investor. So I may say things that are not going to be too pleasant to hear in some cases, and I apologize in advance. Okay, so first of all, what is political risk, in case not everyone is already familiar with this concept? Political risk is basically the possibility to experience losses deriving from negative government actions, which affect the possibility to use, to benefit from the assets that a foreign investor has in a country, or that reduce the value of a firm. And political risk has basically four main categories, which are in this slide. These are the categories that are basically standard in the industry. The first is transfer risk, that is the inability for a foreign investor to convert local currency into foreign exchange and bring it out of the country. The second is seizure of assets, expropriation, basically, which can be either, you know, outright expropriation or creeping expropriation, that is a series of measures that de facto create an expropriation, though without a formal act of expropriation. Third, there is a broad category that goes under political violence, which is basically all kinds of politically motivated violence, ranging from war to internal violence, like riots, insurrections, coups, and so forth. And finally, there is breach of contract, which is basically the repudiation of a contract between a foreign investor and the authorities of the host country. Basically, all these four categories of political risk stem from political decisions, which often are motivated by general macroeconomic and political considerations. And it is on these two kind of issues, on these, in this two, this set of issues that I'm going to focus in my presentation. So let's begin a strict alphabetical order with Bulgaria. In the case of Bulgaria, the from the viewpoint of politics, the key fact is that there are general elections scheduled for mid-2009. Currently, the government is made up of a coalition between the socialists, the movement of Simeon II, and the party of the ethnic Turkish. This government has been reshuffled very recently following some corruption issues, and also a split within the movement of Simeon II, which has a centrist ideological leaning and is not completely at ease in this alliance with the socialists. Some members left for the opposition, and so there's been this change in the composition of the government. With the elections coming in 2009, on one hand, the government is going to leverage public expenditure to, of course, keep consensus and possibly rebuild consensus, especially following the popularity that the opposition led by the mayor of Sofia has gained. And there is also a distinct possibility that further troubles may come from the movement of Simeon II, because the party, as I said, is in an easy situation and could either lose further members due to the pressure of the opposition, which is trying to bring them out of the government, or simply decide to abandon the government. Though this is not strategically a move that I expect, because it doesn't look like a move that will pay off for the party. Should the government basically lose further support from the movement of Simeon II, early elections are very likely, and the opposition led by the mayor of Sofia is definitely in good shape to win these elections. As for the economy, Bulgaria has been doing pretty well recently, but will somehow suffer from the global slowdown of the economy that has nothing to do basically with the country in itself. Also, internal demand, which has been a key factor in the growth of Bulgaria recently, will somehow weaken. But to some extent, at least, it will be replaced as the key driver of the economy by exports, which are doing pretty well and are directed especially towards Germany and Italy. So this for economic growth. In the other key issue with Bulgaria is inflation. Inflation rose a lot during 2007, reasons being the usual suspects: energy costs, costs of foodstuff. But in the case of Bulgaria, there is also an internal element that is represented by the extreme weather conditions that were present in the summer of 2007, which contributed to rise inflation even further. This can be considered as a sort of external shock that probably once eliminated will help bringing inflation down again, but still at levels that are kind of high for the conditions set by the European Union to join the Eurozone, and therefore probably Bulgaria won't be able to join the Eurozone before 2012-2014. There is also vulnerability of the system due to the availability of liquidity in global markets, which can be affected by the credit crunch because of the need of financing for the external sector. So these are basically the key things from the perspective of political risk in Bulgaria. And so what's the key political risk for the country? The key political risk is a civil unrest, which is due mostly to the fact that the process of restructuring and privatization is still ongoing, and it's likely to generate, especially in major cities, business disruptions, and to a lesser extent, asset damage. Other forms of risk that are part of the broad political violence category that we saw at the beginning are the possibility of sporadic forms of civil unrest coming from the Roma community for basically, you know, forms of discrimination. There is a risk of blackmail and possibly even kidnapping for businessmen in urban centers due to the presence of organized crime. And finally, there is also some risk with respect to terrorism because of the participation of Bulgaria in NATO operations, as well as, in general, the pro-US foreign policy adopted by the country. So civil unrest, from the viewpoint of political risk, is the key risk with respect to Bulgaria with the time horizon of 12, 18 months. Second source of risk for Bulgaria is expropriation, especially in the form of creeping expropriation. I apologize, I made this kind of busy slide that probably can't be read too well, but I basically used a single case to make this point, and the case is the case of the Kremikovtsi steel mill. Basically, this mill, which is huge, alone represents 10% of the Bulgarian exports, was first privatized in 1999, sold to a Bulgarian company, and then sold to Global Steel Holdings in 2005. So it became foreign-owned for the majority. And basically, since mid-2007, this company has been targeted by Bulgarian officials with a series of measures that have had a negative impact on the company, especially inspections. They had 55 inspections since mid-2007 with a lot of questionings regarding environmental standards and so forth. Additionally, in November 2007, bondholders requested a reimbursement of the bonds that had been issued by the company a year before, creating a huge problem for Kremikovtsi to operate because they created, of course, a tension with the availability of cash, to the point that the company had to officially admit that they may had to sell. And the most interesting thing is that the CEO of the company, Mr. Alexander Tomov, allegedly suggested to the ownership to sell, fomented somehow the local workers in their request of back pay, and he is well-connected both with local political forces. He has been in the government before, and with the prior owner, Mr. Valentin Zakhariev, who expressed in 2007 his interest in buying again, of course, making a profit out of it, the company from Global Steel Holdings. So this case is obviously unique because of the size of the company and the circumstances, but makes the point that because of the connection between local managers, politicians, and local interests in general, foreign investors may find themselves in a difficult situation, especially in the case of assets in which there is still a participation, an interest from the local authorities. And this is especially true for industries in the mining and energy sectors. Let's move now to Romania. Romania, the key fact with respect to Romania and the political landscape of the country is the contrast that there is between the prime minister and the president. They belong to different parties, and they have been fighting for a significant amount of time by now. The government is a two-party coalition and is a minority government between the National Liberal Party and the Hungarian Democratic Union. Doesn't have the numbers to govern, and basically is surviving thanks to the external support of the Social Democratic Party. This means with elections scheduled for this November, that basically no major reform will be done, given that the government has this difficulty in parliament. And from this viewpoint, in a little bit more than a week, there are going to be local elections, June 1st, which are going to be a very important test, both for the National Liberal Party, which is in power, and for the opposition, the Democratic Liberal Party, which is trying to create the conditions to generate a change in government. With respect to the elections in November, the general elections, at the moment it seems that they are going to be very tight, so it's very difficult to predict who could win them. In case the opposition doesn't score the success that it is hoping to score, there is also a possibility that the Social Democratic Party will actually enter the governing coalition in order to create a broader support for the government. There have been talks already between the leaders in this sense, though it seems kind of difficult from a policy perspective, because the Social Democratic Party and the National Liberal Party have very different agendas and positions on many, many issues, and therefore stricter collaboration doesn't seem too easy. The fact that there is this ongoing conflict between the prime minister and the president, as we will see later, is very important for the risks that we can identify with respect to Romania. Let's now see the economy. With respect to the economy, Romania has been doing well recently, as Bulgaria, and with the elections coming this November, Romania is not likely to experience any decrease in economic growth because of public expenditure. We can expect public expenditure to keep up the growth of the Romanian economy despite the slowdown of the global markets. After the elections, there will be also some slowdown in Romania because, of course, public expenditure will be restrained, and there will be most likely tighter fiscal policies. As for Bulgaria, a problem is inflation. Inflation has gone up, and as I said before, inflation is one of the key things to access the Eurozone, and therefore this is a major problem. The rise of inflation, also in this case, has been due mostly to energy costs and food prices, and also we can expect public expenditure and increasing salaries to play a part in the rise of inflation. And there is also a problem with the widening current account deficit, which for the moment is, however, under control. So what's the primary risk from the perspective of political risk with respect to Romania? The primary risk is actually the microeconomic imbalance, and the two major problems are inflation and the widening current account deficit. This problem, however, has roots that basically are political and can be identified in the ongoing conflict between the Prime Minister and the President, which basically creates a situation that doesn't produce the reforms that would be needed to address the macroeconomic problems. In terms of civil unrest, instead, Romania is far less risky than Bulgaria because the privatization process and the reforming process has been mostly done, and therefore there are, you know, certainly there will be some kind of business disruptions, particularly in the mining sector in heavy industry, but generally speaking, from this viewpoint, the risk is inferior when we compare Romania to Bulgaria. And still in the field in the broad group of political violence, there is also for Romania some risk of exposure to terrorist attacks, because, as in the case of Bulgaria, of the pro-US foreign policy and the presence of Islamists ready to promote attacks. However, these attacks most likely would have as targets not local targets, but Western and Israeli targets. So to conclude, what is basically what are the similarities and the differences between these two countries that have a lot in common, beginning with the common access to the European Union? There is, first of all, a significant political instability, which has different roots in the two countries, but still is one of the factors that stand out with respect to the general political environment. With respect to the macroeconomic situation, the key issue is inflation, because both countries are, of course, trying to get in line with the requirements to join the Eurozone, and inflation is one of the most important variables in this equation. So inflation stands out as a key problem from the macroeconomic viewpoint. And finally, what is different? Different is, as we just said, basically the main risk from the perspective of a foreign investor, which is in one case is the macroeconomic instability in the case of Romania, and in another case, in the case of Bulgaria, is instead civil unrest. And thank you for listening, and I think we can.
Okay, thank you very much, Ugo. Svetlana, it's your turn. I think your PowerPoint's already. You can stay there. Oh.
So, good afternoon, everybody. I will kind of, you know, step back, I guess, from more specific issues and talk about broader investment climate things. So as we all know, investment climate puzzle consists of, you know, many different elements. So we heard about political risk, and there is obviously issues of personal safety and security and macroeconomic conditions. So what the Doing Business project looks at is the regulatory environment, which also is a very important piece of this puzzle. The methodology of the project is quite simple. We look at this 10 different indicators using a standardized case. We look at a domestic company and follow a full cycle of its life. Every major transaction that this company would have to do from starting a business to closing a business. I would like to stress that we do not specifically look at foreign investors, but what we found that countries that rank highly in the Doing Business ranking actually do not differentiate between foreign and domestic investors. So they create a plain level field for both kind of investors, which makes sense. Many of us remember a story of Russia in the 90s when domestic capital flight was much higher than actually foreign investment inflowing into the country. One of the reasons, besides political uncertainty, is, of course, that the regulations were not conducive for domestic entrepreneurs to stay within the country. So who are the countries that do well in our rankings? You will find that four countries of the former Soviet bloc do extremely well. Estonia, Georgia, Latvia, and Lithuania rank among the top 30 countries on the ease of doing business, creating a truly competitive environment for companies to come and start up. Georgia is rather a remarkable case. 2 years ago, Georgia ranked 113 on the ease of doing business. And of course, the new democratic government came in on a reform agenda and aggressively reformed business regulations. Why reforms are so important? Again, case of Georgia, since the reforms started taking place a couple of years ago, we found that the number of companies that started in Georgia increased by 55%. Meanwhile, unemployment dropped by 2%. There is a direct correlation between regulatory reforms and a number of companies starting up and therefore creating new jobs. Eastern Europe and Central Asia as a region has been doing extremely well in our ranking. So now, as an average, it ranks just behind the OECD countries. And this is a new development. Last year, it was the third top-ranked region. Although you will see that this region also spread out quite widely in the ranking. We have these four countries that rank in the top 30, but on the other hand, we have countries that rank in the lower hundreds. I would like to single out my own country, Russia, that actually consistently doing worse and worse every year in the ranking. We've seen quite a few encouraging reforms coming out of Russia in the 90s, but in the 200s, there was really nothing of significance. And Russia, again, is a good case to highlight why giving additional incentives to foreign investment might not be the best strategy. Again, many of us are familiar with the case of Exxon, when the government actually came and renegotiated the special conditions they were given to the foreign investor. Our project tracks performance of countries and also the number of positive and negative regulatory reforms that were introduced in a given year. Again, you will see that Eastern Europe and Central Asia is leading in terms of number of economic reforms. One of the major reasons was accession to European Union. Countries were actually forced to improve their regulatory environment to be able to join the EU. Who are the top reformers? Again, you see Croatia, Macedonia, Georgia, and Bulgaria, countries that either recently joined EU or with strong European aspirations. An interesting thing that we found is that the government typically reform within first 15 months to coming to power. After, you know, year and a half, very few governments have the appetite for reforms. So what kind of reforms are we talking about? It's typically cutting red tape and consolidating procedures and also cutting cost to starting a business, registering property, getting construction permits, and so on and so forth. Here's just the one example of such a reform in Georgia. Another successful example of starting a business reform in Macedonia. Again, high requirement of a minimum capital requirement was found to be a major factor that prevents companies to start in certain countries. And we see strong indications that when this minimum capital requirement is scrapped, more companies start up. Property registration. I mean, obviously, property rights are very important for both domestic and foreign investors. In our research, we found that when cost is prohibitive to formally register a company, or if rules are not clear and transparent or high bribes are needed to be paid, then companies and individuals prefer to stay in informal sector, which means that they cannot register their property formally and cannot use it as a collateral and get credit from the banking system. Taxes, obviously, is a major factor that is of concern for investors. Again, we're looking at two sides. It's the tax administration and also tax rates. So we found then, again, when the tax rules are clear and filing rules are simple, then more people tend to file taxes. Same with high or low tax rates. I recently had a conversation with a colleague from Bulgaria, and there was a strong indication that lowering taxes actually widening the taxpayer base. So even though the overall rate is low, the government gets more revenue because more companies are now encouraged to pay taxes. At the end of the day, both domestic and foreign investors look at one thing. It's obviously shareholder returns. And we started this research project this year looking at reforming countries and the rate of return. And what we found that many countries that have been reforming aggressively in the past years actually have a higher shareholder returns. And I would encourage you to visit our website. And it has a wealth of additional information. Also, if there are any questions, I will be happy to answer.
Okay, thank you, Svetlana. We have plenty of time, actually, for questions to both the panelists. Call upon anybody with the first comments, questions, clarifications. Bill?
One quick question, Hugo. How does the issue of corruption factor into political risk? Is it in there or buried in there? Or is it something that's not...
Well, it plays some part because it can contribute to create you know, situations that generate political risk. However, it is not strictly like one of the major determinants of risk, because political risk comes from government decisions, you know, whatever they are, but as long as they are having a negative impact on businesses. Now, if these decisions have at their basis as a motivation factors that are somehow related to corruption, then of course there is an impact. In the case specific of breach of contract, for instance, which is the case I referred to during the presentation, corruption can be a somehow at the basis of, for instance, of the decision that a government can make to frustrate a contract with a foreign investor. So in that sense, it can play a role. But I would say it's more relevant to issues of business environment, of course, because there it's a central, it's a key factor. While basically here can be a sort of trigger that can lead, you know, governments to take certain decisions, but the focus here is really on the decisions that are taken by governments.
If I can just build on this point, high quality of regulations is highly correlated with low corruption when it comes to obtaining permits, licensing, registering property, or starting a business. The Central and Eastern Europe blog, luckily, many governments actually taking the regulations online. So everybody has access and everybody has an understanding what are the rules of the game and which agencies they're supposed to visit. But again, unfortunately, all of these countries has this difficult Soviet legacy of extremely complicated, for example, construction permitting requirements. When it takes years in most of these countries to obtain a set of documents to build a simple commercial warehouse, for example. Now, we have countries of the former Soviet Union where it's over 2 years, and obviously no one will wait for 2 years. They will just, start a project illegally. So why we look at construction sector? Because it's a major sector that forms, GDP of any given country. So again, by simplifying regulations and making it very clear what is required, and creating closed lists for example, the refusal of certain license and not leaving it at the discretion of a particular bureaucrat, that will lead to, certainty and obviously better regulatory environment.
Please, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Richard Young. I work for Gabriel Resources, and we're working to develop a large gold deposit in Romania. And I guess for both of you, with Bulgaria and Romania joining the European Union, there were a lot of changes to regulations, and it was excellent, and we've been there for 10 years, and we saw those, and we were quite encouraged. There's a certain capacity issue with you adopt EU regulations, but nobody's really quite sure how they work, whether it's the government, the lawyers, your business advisor. So there's a bit of a hurdle to get over, and it takes time, and I think companies have to be patient. But in Romania, there is uncertainty because of the politics underway. For both countries, particularly Romania, there are elections coming up in the fall. Do we believe that some stability will come after those elections politically, whatever political outcome there is? Because in any last year of any government, they're normally unwilling to, make a lot of policy changes, as was highlighted. But do we think that with joining the EU now, there was a push coming into the EU on reform, maybe both countries have taken a bit of a step back. Do we think that after the next elections they'll start to move forward? Do we think that the pressures, the economic pressures in Romania and then some of the civil pressures and outside influences from the EU will start to push them back down that line? Because certainly in Romania, the workforce is tremendous. They're well-educated, they're hardworking, and I think that Bulgaria and Romania can catch up to Western Europe, but it's not going to be able to do that if it doesn't have political stability and rule of law and the deregulation that you spoke about.
If I could just add on to that, because it links with Richard's question. You mentioned, Ugo, in terms of business disruption, in addition to macroeconomic uncertainty, if not instability, that there's a small but nevertheless an existing moderate risk to, you said, I think, mining and heavy industry. Could you be a little bit more specific what that would entail? I mean, are you talking about this Bulgarian type of model that you outlined or something else? I mean, you're talking about government interference, you're talking about civil disruption.
Yes, I'm thinking more about strikes and demonstrations that can affect businesses in the short term. More than intervention directly from the government. So this is the kind of risk that I was talking about. But as I said, I mean, for the case of Romania, I think it is not that much. Most of this has already happened during the 90s with huge demonstrations that had a much broader impact. So in that sense, I think that, of course, things can always change very, very quickly, as we know. But given the current outlook and the current conditions, it doesn't seem to be a major problem for Romania. And to follow up on the first question, I think that certainly the EU membership is a tremendous incentive to make reforms and improve in a number of areas, because there are basically sanctions that can be put in place. There is economic aid that can be suspended, and also there is this bid of both countries to join the Eurozone, which requires a lot of discipline that has to be pursued if they want, as I believe they do, they want to join the Eurozone. With respect to the political stability, I think, and therefore the likelihood that reforms are made, I think it depends a lot on the outcome of the elections, because if you have a government with a strong support in parliament, and it's much easier to reform and to adopt policies that can actually help manage whatever it is needed to be managed, like in the case of Romania, these macroeconomic imbalances. If you have a case in which there is a narrow majority or even a minority government with external support, the conflict between the prime minister and the president, all this creates a situation that is not very good for undertaking major reforms, which require certainly also some kind of consensus building that you can only have if you have a broad coalition and a broad support. So in that sense, I think that voters ultimately will decide what's going to happen, because if they will give a clear majority to one of the parties, there will be more chances to reform, rather than if there is a very fragmented situation.
I think EU membership provides actually a certain safety net when it comes to regulatory reforms, because it's not up to the government, just the government, whether to reform or not. There is, for example, an EU directive on regulatory simplification, which directs every government of EU to cut 25% of the existing regulations by, I believe, 2012. So this is non-negotiable, and this will happen in every given country. It's just the question of, how and when exactly. But we had a very good experience with Central European countries in general, and their appetite for reforms, and of course, majority or minority government plays a big role, but nevertheless, even if it's a coalition government, you're very likely to see more reforms of the business environment.
Thank you. My name is Peter Kusek. I'm with the World Bank. I have a question primarily for Ugo, I think. If I'm a foreign investor looking at a country where I know that the political risk is quite high, what can I do to better protect myself and better protect the investment? In addition to getting, say, insurance or guarantee from OPIC or MIGA or private insurer, is it, in fact, effective to have a contract, investment contract, or an agreement with stronger protections for your investment? Does it make a difference if my home country has a bilateral investment treaty or some other treaty with the country? If we know that the problem is not that the contracts are not good, that the laws are not good, or the regulations do not exist, but in fact that the governments breach the contracts or disregard the laws and expropriate or breach the contracts? Or is it effective to find a local partner and go in as a joint venture so that the government is not quite as likely to act against your investment? What would you advise a foreign company?
Well,
thank you.
It depends a lot on the local situation, and certainly protection coming from a contract is useful if the contract is going to be respected, so to speak. So, and you know, I don't know in the case that you are mentioning whether this is the case, but certainly a way to manage risk is to spread it. So, bringing on board the local partners, especially if they have good connections with the government, is certainly something that can help avoiding negative actions like expropriations. Of course, with the risk still there that they may work something, you know, on your back, so to speak. So I would say that finding local partners is definitely a way to manage the risk, making sure, however, that you choose the right local partners, and then, you know, any kind of way you can spread the risk through contracts, you know, kind of setting beforehand how the losses would be split between, for instance, the company and the contractors, if the laws are, you know, respected and the, you know, judiciary works. That's certainly another tool that can be used to manage political risk.
Excuse me, George Predescu with the Romanian Embassy in Washington. Just as a general comment, I would say that Romania and Bulgaria are probably the most attractive markets in the European Union right now. Tons of euros are pouring in those two countries, specifically from Italy, from Germany, from UK, from all the countries in EU. Also, U.S. is very, 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 you know, eager to invest in Romania. You mentioned about the conflict between the Prime Minister and the President. You never said anything about what the conflict is about. People will question what you meant, conflict between the Prime Minister and the President. Let me tell you about the conflict. The two men just a few months ago got into a great consensus when Ford, just an example, decided to got into the market with a great investment in Romania. The two men were the heads of the NATO summit in Bucharest a month ago, the largest summit in NATO's history. Well, if they have disagreements, what's wrong about that? How that conflict, as you define it, could delay economic growth or reforms? I don't understand. The president has no executive powers at all, but he's a very outspoken person. That's true. He's a former ship captain. You know, he's very direct. But has no executive powers. You know, about the political stability, well, we have Italy that changes governments every 3 months, and everything is going well. And this is an example of how EU is working. You know, you set the rules. If, you know, we had a social democrat, a left government from 2000 to 2004. Now we have a liberal party. What's wrong about that? Governments change and parliaments change, but in the European Union, you have the guarantee that the stability is there. I don't see a problem with having elections and changing or early elections. What's wrong about that? Thank you.
With the elections, there is certainly no problem at all, and actually they are a very useful thing for democracy. So I've never said that elections are a problem. What I said is that no, I did not. So
much political stability.
But that's one thing, and having election is a completely different thing. I'm sorry. And in any event, if there is no conflict, the problems I mentioned will be faced and addressed, so that's going to be great.
What's the conflict?
Exactly. Well, there is this is the perception that okay, well, thanks for telling me.
Just here to clarify things.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, there are disagreements on some issues, but again, the president has no executive powers. He speaks very powerful for his beliefs,
mm-hmm.
but that's not being, it's not a, you know, it's not like he can change. I mean, from a perspective of an investor, and again, we are talking about countries that just joined a market where, you know, rules are very strict. And
they certainly are.
Exactly. But in the last years, we see a lot of investments coming in all these new EU countries, irrespective of the fact that the president has a different view than the prime minister in Romania. But in Bulgaria or Poland or Hungary or Czech Republic, there are disagreements for sure. But still, for an investor point of view, that's the topic of the debate today. I would not be discouraged at all. Because the two leaders are in disagreement of some matters, talking for Romania.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, the question is whether those political disagreements have an impact on economic policy, macroeconomic stability, and investment opportunities. So are you saying they do in some way?
I'm saying they do, because basically without much stability is hardly possible to address major issues, but that's a viewpoint.
If I can just add briefly, I think it's important to remember that the new democracies, countries that just joined the EU or about to join the EU, face tremendous competition among themselves. So they're gaining access to this EU market. And again, this access comes with certain, rules. And the governments tend to be quite rational about this because each of these countries is trying to get a bigger piece of the pie. And they know what's involved. So, I agree with a colleague that, of course, the situation when there is a consensus government and, total majority in the parliament is probably the best in terms of reforms. But on the other hand, any opposition in any parliament realizes that, now is the time. If reforms are not made now, then 2 years later it'll be just too late because someone else has already gotten a bigger piece of the pie.
Please.
If you could look to the mic.
Gabor Szabó from the Hungarian Embassy. I'm just wondering, because you highlighted the terrorist risk as a country risk in both countries. Do you think that they are in a higher risk than any other Western European or U.S. company or U.S. Country? Or is this a specific country-specific risk?
No, it's it's...
Because you highlighted it.
Yes,
as a country.
Well, I highlighted it because it's part of the risks that are considered when,
Yeah, but risk is always a relative thing. Risk compared to other countries?
Well, not necessarily, because when you invest in a country, you are concerned with the risk in that country, regardless of the risk that there is in another country. So, this doesn't mean that at all that the risk is higher in these two countries than elsewhere.
From that point of view, this is not the risk of the country. This is the risk of the business anywhere in the world.
Well, these days, terrorist risk is widespread. So, of course, depending also on the kind of stance that a certain country has on these issues, the risk can be higher or smaller.
Are they in this category?
Well, with many other countries, so it's not particular. And I put it at the bottom of my list, mm-hmm. precisely because it wasn't that big.
Is there any particular evidence that it's not just because of help in the U.S. and Iraq? There are two U.S. Not bases, yes. But two positions with U.S. troops.
No, there are some reports that they have circulated in the past couple of years. So and intelligence information highlighting the possibility of attacks that, as I said, would, in any event, have as main targets, most likely, Western and Israeli targets. And also Bulgaria, for instance, has a large Turkish component in its population, and there is evidence that Islamists have made some inroads in this population. So all these points to a possible possible risk in the in this sense.
Anybody else, please?
My name is Arben Hairallahu. I am a scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in D.C. And in your analysis about risk, do you take the regional stability as a factor? The first question. And the second question, what about the organized crimes and politics? Do you see any we know in the region, in the whole Balkan region, but as well as in all the regions, this cooperation between the somehow between the organized crime and the politician and the power?
Yes. Well, organized crime certainly is part of the picture, and I mentioned when I was discussing the case of Bulgaria, for instance, that organized crime was one of the factors that prompted the cabinet reshuffle in late April, because there were allegations that staff of the Ministry of Interior had passed on information to people from organized crime organizations. And also when I mentioned the relative risk in within the civil unrest of possible kidnappings or blackmails to which business people could be subject, especially in major cities, again the root is the presence of organized crime. So certainly organized crime plays a role in triggering these kind of events, and as with respect to what was your first question?
On regional stability.
Regional.
All your indicators deal just with the Romania or Bulgarian case, but you never mentioned the regional stability as a factor playing in the foreign investments. And to the last question again, you are saying that it exists organized crime, but my question is, do you see any link between the organized crime and politicians that in those two case studies? Thank you.
As I said, the link, for instance, in the case of the recent scandal that involved the Ministry of the Interior in Bulgaria was precisely of that nature. And as for regional stability, it is relevant to the extent that regional elites and authorities are relevant to investors. And keep in mind that the funds that are coming from the European Union generally are managed at subnational level in many cases. So to that extent, they are the subnational level is certainly a relevant aspect to consider.
Okay, I think we'll stop then. We'll have thank you very much to our two speakers, and we won't have a break, we'll just have a quick turnaround. So if the two next speakers come to the front. They both have PowerPoints, I believe, as well. We're on to our favourite subject, corruption and judicial reform. And two speakers, Andrew Wilson, who's Regional Director, Eastern Europe, Eurasia, South Asia at the Centre for International Private Business, or Private Enterprise. And David Bernstein, Senior Public Sector Specialist, Europe and Central Asia, World Bank. So, do we start with you, Andrew?
Yes, I think that's where we are in the introduction. Thanks very much, Janusz. Just a quick word on CIP, SIPE, before we begin. I know some faces around the table that I've seen over at our place, but for those of you who don't know who we are, We're an affiliate of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and one of the core institutes of the National Endowment for Democracy. And we're created to promote democracy through economic reform and private sector development around the world. We are primarily a grant-making organization, although we do some work in-house. And as such, that means our work often gets directed by the grantees to whom we give money, which are business associations and think tanks and policy institutes in emerging markets. And over the years, as we have given grants over the last 25 years, we've noticed certain trends or areas of focus that keep coming back to us or growing. The informal sector is one of them. Corporate governance is another section. And corruption is also top of the list. And I think all of these areas are interrelated, and as I work through my presentation here, they come back to a lot of the comments we heard from the first panel, is that the institutions in a country, whether it's the court system or the bureaucracy, play a very important role in determining where a country stands on these doing business rankings, where they stand on TI, anti-corruption rankings, or other things. So we'll keep that in mind as we move forward. In general, I think as a rule of thumb, if we look at corruption patterns throughout the world, we have seen at least a growing awareness and a lot more organizations paying attention to corruption, whether it's the work led by Transparency International or the OECD's conventions. The World Bank has done a lot of great work on it. Our own organization, as I said, is focusing on it. We tend to get, I think, a feeling that we're making a lot of progress in fighting corruption. I would posit, that if we look around us right now and we look at what's happening at Siemens or other major leading companies, we may not be making the level of progress in actually fighting the corruption that we are. We certainly are making good progress in identifying what it looks like, the patterns that exist, but in the actual, and maybe even enforcing it, and perhaps that's a more important point to make. But as far as corruption itself goes, where either government officials use their office for private gain or within companies themselves in their private-to-private relationships, you know, those patterns still exist. And if anything, a survey that was released by Ernst & Young this week and highlighted in CFO Magazine, I think, brings out the nature of what we're dealing with in corruption. And this was a global survey of which about a quarter of the sample came from Central and Eastern Europe. So there's a good strong representation of the business community there. It was a survey of finance executives inside companies, 1,200 of them in 33 countries. The two statistics that really came out and jumped at me was that out of these companies, 23% of these companies reported being asked for bribes during the course of their work. So we were looking about one in four companies are still having to deal with this on a yearly basis. And 18% of those report losing business opportunities to competitors who did pay bribes. So one in five. We still have significant levels of corruption to dealing with. As far as Central and Eastern Europe goes, you know, certainly the region, because of its transitional nature, where we did not only had to have an economic transition, but a transition of institutions, garnered a reputation through the late 80s and through the 90s as you know, the home of wild west capitalism and all of that we tended to associate with it, including corruption. But I think the region over the last few years really has become an interesting area to look at in terms of corruption in institutions, because I think it's a source of mixed news, and certainly a source of a lot of interesting ideas and approaches that have come out of really what's been a hothouse for trying new things over the last 15 years. You know, a lot of ideas were tried out, a lot of approaches have been tried out in Central and Eastern Europe, and I think we have a lot to gain from that. My presentation today, I want to just look at three broad areas while we're sitting here. One is to try and look at the effect that EU integration has had on levels of corruption and practices within these countries, and then take a look at maybe some of the non-related trends and look at some countries that have not yet assessed to the EU and see how they compare against the European Union, countries that have joined the Union. And finally, I would like to share with you a little bit of the experience that we have garnered over the last 15 years working in this region the approaches that people have come up with and some of the more practical approaches that companies can take towards ameliorating some of the risks involved with investment into the region. So now, don't be intimidated by this next slide. It's only up there just for wallpaper. But I will point out a few things. This is the TI Corruptions Perception Index from 2001, 2003, and 2007. I chose these 3 years to illustrate a point. I wanted us to be able to compare where countries were before they entered the EU as far as their citizens' perceptions of corruption go and where they are right now, 2 or 3 years down the road, assuming that legislations and regulations are in place and that systems are functioning. So the number you see on the left is where a country would rank within the TI index for that year. The number in yellow on the right was the actual score that the country got. But let's take a – before we get too involved with the chart and things, let's just take a couple of general observations here. One is, I would say, especially in the 2007 figures, there often, I think, is probably a lag between reality and perception when you're looking at statistics like corruption perception indicators. Corruption within the companies, corruption in the state may be reducing, but here we're talking about people's perceptions, and our understanding is this actually could be a couple of years, a couple of year lag point between the time that, you know, steps may actually be taking and systems may be in place and working, and the public actually agrees that they see change happening. So grain of salt with the numbers on the yellow. And also, these are mean numbers. There's if you go deeper into TI figures, there's a range that they put up based on the number of samples they try and other elements. But I think the overall conclusion I'd like to put forward to you is that while corruption still exists in the region, and you can see by the rankings that some countries are pretty solidly sort of moving into the middle third, top or bottom of the top third and into the middle of the middle third of countries within the TI sample. Corruption, I think, still exists in the region, but I think the nature of corruption is also changing, and there's some good World Bank analysis on that out there if people want to look for it. I don't think it's the barrier to investment that it once was, particularly when we talk about the corruptions in the areas of private-to-private investment or areas where companies were going into privatization and into countries where institutions were fairly weak during the 1990s and therefore investors were more susceptible to shady dealing. And the type of corruption I would characterize in at least in the EU integration countries is much less mendacious than it was. You may still be paying a few entry fees here and there, but it's not going to make or break the deal as much as it used to. It's not going to rob you blind like it used to. I remember having a seminar back at SIPE about 10 years ago where we were talking about investment in Romania. And there was a Romanian four-wheel drive manufacturer named Aero, a company that was manufacturing cars. And an American investor showed up at the seminar literally in tears as he talked about his story about how – and he admitted in the position that they had been forced to pay bribes, that they had lost some $2 million in trying to generate this investment in the country to do a joint venture partnership with Aero. And in the end, the whole deal fell through. And there was no accountability they could get out of any government officials or anything else. Those kind of stories you don't hear anymore; they're gone. You do hear occasional stories, as we did with Bulgaria last week, with the road minister and public procurement, and both Romania and EU have had their wrists slapped by the EU lately over continuing levels of corruption. But it's not nearly on the scale we used to see it. I think it's generally a positive story to be told. The other option I would make on the TI statistics is that if you look at the white numbers and you compare them to yellow numbers over the years, you'll see in a lot of cases corruption may have actually – perceptions may have actually reduced or remained static, but their positioning within the overall chart remains lower or drops. And I think what this points out to us is the growing competitive nature of these types of indices. Countries are now realizing that it is important to be higher up the indices, like on the doing business when you look at Georgia skyrocket up the list. Countries that really wanted to improve and get a better position are going up. Also, there are a lot more people in the sample now, a lot more countries being sampled. So you could be doing a better job on it, and you can still get kicked down the table. So what I really would draw your attention to is more the yellow numbers or the scores that we see there. And the other option I would say is over time, I think this competitive nature and this with the atmosphere of the Doing Business Report and other things are really driving these reforms in countries. These are you know, people do have to compete against their neighbors. They do have to compete on a regional basis. And it does matter how you're viewed in relation to your neighbor in a lot of cases. So I think Svetlana's point is very important. What I would say here is that we've kind of broken down into two groups within these statistics here. For most of these countries, and I would point out in general, just on for my quick reference here, Slovenia, Estonia, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia, if you compare them back to 2001, these tend to be the countries that have shown the greatest gains in improving their transparency rating. I would also just point out that there are also the countries that tend to have undertaken market-oriented reforms that have been fairly simple. In other words, they've gone towards simplifying the system, reducing the amount of times and points of contact that bureaucrats have with individual companies, and as such, or individuals within society, and as such, have reaped the benefits in lower scores. Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Bulgaria. This is where you kind of get into the mixed story. You say, well, let's look at Hungary, for instance. Before they really began the acquis process, we looked at a perception rating of 5.3. The year before they entered the market in 2003, when you would assume that most of these reforms had been put in place, these laws have changed. By the way, the higher the score, the better. We were up at 4.8, or down to 4.8, and we've bounced back up. But it's remained relatively static, which makes one wonder, with all this attention to the issue and with all these regulations that you adopt, why aren't you seeing real changes in public perception? I'll get back to what I think is the answer in a moment. We've also seen a great increase in Romania over the years, but it still is a bit of an outlier there as far as the corruption perception index goes. And that's all I'll say about that at this point. The other thing I'd like to point out, and it sort of came up in the discussion following Svetlana's presentation, is that we also have a gap between regulation on paper and implementation. And in the realms of corruption, that's what's really important. You can bring a country up to a key status pretty quickly. It's not a pretty process, but parliaments have been known to ram through a lot of regulations and laws very quickly. It's your ability to implement these laws at the bureaucratic level that are important. And I think that might be one of these reasons why you don't see Herculean jumps in perceptions of the quality of the level of corruption, is that quite simply a lot of these policies take time to roll down into the bureaucracy, and we're still in a process of where those are being adapted. Our studies have shown, and our partner studies have shown, that access to information is critical if you're going to address corruption. People have to know the laws and regulations that affect them. They need to know what sort of remedies they can take and what rights and responsibilities government officials have. And I think in general in EU countries with coming into the EU, they have improved access to information. There's much more transparency in the regulatory environment. People can understand the framework within they're operating. And I think for foreign investors, that's a very important step. Also suggest that government procurement has improved dramatically throughout the region. We do still see, as we did in Bulgaria this week with the road building scandal, that there are still some high-profile cases of corruption that exist. But in the large part, coming into the EU and other forms of foreign assistance have helped many countries adapt better public procurement systems, better yet in countries where they have moved to electronic procurement, such as Estonia. Where we see the worst gaps, and this will be borne out in the next slide as well, tend to be in those countries where institutions are weakest or where they are still evolving and strengthening. So, Bulgaria and Romania, not in the EU as long perhaps, still building these institutions, still making the transition into the EU framework, still working on it. But again, the score is generally going up for Romania there, at least as they undertake that. If we compare that to non-EU countries in the region, where I've boxed it out is just, you know, there were no statistics available for that year. We've only just begun getting statistics in place. You can see in general they're further down the TI list to begin with, and the scores take a dramatic drop over on the perceptions index. But if you look at the countries involved within here, and these are ranked again according to where they fall on the 2007 ranking, it does still seem to suggest that at least proximity to EU, whether it's being driven by the accession process, so countries that are coming into the acquis communautaire or looking towards doing some sort of stabilization agreement, or else regional competitiveness, which is another theory that could be out there, may be driving reform in some countries. A country that comes to mind to me is Montenegro, which is really done a lot in the realm of simplification of its regulations, improving its investment environment, because it recognizes the need to be competitive within its regional marketplace. And I think there are very positive trends to be seen there, and I think those will be reflected probably next year in their findings. So you do see Serbia and Montenegro and Croatia really taking a lead on this. And making some good strides. The asterisk is that I couldn't get 2003 statistics there, but those are 2005 statistics for Serbia and Montenegro, which may even suggest even a faster rate of progress. Bosnia, Albania, Moldova, again, more leading towards stagnation. We're not seeing a lot of movement within those countries. And I would suggest that what we see in general in the Balkans as the atmosphere of corruption also may have something to do with the fact that a lot of these countries still possess weak institutions and or that their transformational process was somehow stalled by conflict, sanctions, or other internal strife that reduced the effect of government or the ability of government to either concentrate on these or else helped corrupt regimes stay in power. I mean, or corrupt systems stay in power. If you look at the way, for instance, Bosnia is set up in its political and economic fashions. There's a circular relationship there that keeps generating corruption. But I think the link to draw here that I'd like to bring your attention to, and more importantly, and for us at SIPE it's important, is the link to democracy and corruption. And I think what we see throughout both of these charts as we go down is that the more democracy you inject into a country, the more you have the systems and the practices of democracy, the less corruption you tend to have. And I put three countries on here at the bottom to kind of illustrate this. You can't see at the bottom, but we have Kazakhstan at the bottom, where we have seen a democracy deficit, where the trends of democracy have reversed in the region. We see Russia pretty much, although its score is stabilizing, it has dropped from number 79 to 143 on the rankings over the last 6 years. Belarus, in the period of 3 years, has gone from a score of 4.2 down to 2.1, which is far beyond any sort of measure of error. I mean, that's a real drop. And finally, what you can't see on the chart here is Kazakhstan, which, again, its scores have dropped over the years from a 2.7 down to a 2.1. I put Kazakhstan on there because it illustrates the broader trends throughout Central Asia. Pretty much all the countries further east you go where you see this democracy deficit, you're seeing drops in corruption perceptions. What will be interesting to look at, just as an aside, is to take a look at a country like Uzbekistan, which is a bottom of the league table in corruption, but has made some very important moves towards liberalizing their economy. And I think if we look at that in a couple of years, we can compare whether democracy or liberalization has an impact on levels of corruption. Russia is someplace I just wanted to point out because it's so big and it has such an influence throughout the region, and we'll hear about that later this afternoon. But our partners in Russia have studied the situation there, and the estimate there is that 50% of GDP is in corruption right now. It's a pretty dire state. And where I talked about the sort of mendacious form of corruption, it's still alive and kicking in Russia in a variety of forms. This is a sign outside a milk store in Moscow which says, "Help us, we're being attacked by raiders." This is a particular form of mendacious corruption that's plaguing more medium-sized and small businesses in Russia than the large businesses. But essentially, if you take what happened to Yukos 3 or 4 years ago, where interested parties used state instruments to essentially violate people's property rights and steal their assets. This is now being repeated at a local level all across the country, and people who have medium-sized businesses that have success and are making money are now facing the same sort of thing where a minority shareholder within a firm might lodge a complaint within a court system that's corrupt, lock up the assets of a company until such a point that the owner of the company is forced to sell to that minority shareholder. Or another typical trick that's used is that an ally of someone within a local government has their eye on a company, and the tax inspectors show up and start tearing the place apart. Tax collectors get a bit of a taste after they take the company apart. Essentially, the company's forced into bankruptcy, forced into sale by the tax administration, and the people are able to pick it up for a highly discounted rate. And we already know where that auction is going to go at that time. The other point about Russia I wanted to make very quickly was that Russia also ranks at the bottom of TI's league table on the Bribe Payers Index, which is a list of companies or countries, people's perception of countries where corrupt investors come from, people who are most likely to pay bribes. There's only 30 countries that are examining at this point. Russia, I believe, sits at number 29. No other countries in the region are even close to it. But these are really the top 30 exporter countries they take a look at. But I would note that they're down at the bottom with China and India. So in general, I think the BRIC countries have a business environment that may foster those types of trends. As far as the tools go for fighting corruption, we have broken it down into internal and external tools. These are projects we've supported in the past. If you're going into these environments and you're investing, there's certain things that you can do as a business to protect yourself. One are the TI business principles for countering bribery. That's about setting up internal controls within your company. What is best practice? What can you do to protect yourself and ensure not only that you're not susceptible to government harassment, but also that your employees are not conducting any sort of private-to-private corruption within their own corporate procurement. Trace is a very interesting approach. When companies are entering a new market, they are often doing so through an intermediary, a local partner. But if you're operating under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, you're as liable to be tried for corrupt actions if you're working through a local partner as you are if it's your own employees doing this. So working and certifying local partners becomes very critical and expensive for companies. Trace was set up by compliance officers within companies to actually create a certification system for intermediaries to help companies who want to go into a market, who want to look at a market, find an intermediary who they know is clean and will not bribe on their behalf before they enter. And finally, I could spend 2 hours on corporate governance, but you know, a lot of the abuses we saw, a lot of the corruption we saw, a lot of the loss of property rights that we saw in the private sector when it came to investing in firms, not only in Eastern Europe but in Russia, has to do with abuses of corporate governance. And if companies look at improving their internal control systems, making sure that minority shareholder rights are improved, and that there's transparency within accounting systems, they can protect themselves more so than they can otherwise. I'll note that a lot of good progress has been made in Eastern, Central, and Eastern Europe. Many countries have adopted corporate governance codes, tighter listing requirements for publicly traded companies, and we're seeing better regulation and oversight in the securities markets. However, the court system remains a big question mark. It's very weak. It's a system that's built on a foundation of sand, and unless we address the courts and their ability to adjudicate and enforce these types of laws and practices, it's not going to mean much. And external controls, the one point I would make, a big point I would make on this is the need for collective action. Companies are not going to do this stuff by themselves. There are some areas like the OECD and the UN that are offering sort of international compacts and other things that companies can sign on to. But if we're really going to look at effective practice to address corruption in the regional level, we've got to look at companies working together at a country level through business associations, primarily because they offer anonymity and a layer of protection for companies. Companies don't want to do this on their own. They've got too much at risk. They really need to work through collective action. These are a few tools that we've developed that are used by coalitions, particularly in Russia, with some success. Improving access to information, I mentioned. Assessing draft laws and regulations for corruption potential before they get passed into law. We now have a guidebook out that will take a business person or an association person through the steps of how to read a piece of legislation and then how to identify where there's certain corruption potential points. Hotlines are used by small and medium businessmen to learn out about what their rights are and also to report corruption, and the associations work with MOUs with local governments to address it as it arises. Integrity pacts, another, this is a very complex and a difficult thing to do, but it's where the government and business agree that procurement will happen in a transparent transparent environment, and where steps for adjudication can be employed if allegations of corruption arise. And finally, just a quick promotion out there. Next week, the World Bank Institute, we've been working with them, are releasing a new document that they've spearheaded. We've been working with them. Grant Thornton, Siemens has been there. The UN Global Compact, the Global Advice Network of Denmark have all been cooperating on a new a collective action toolkit for companies wishing to look at how they can work more effectively against corruption. And finally, for those of you who like case studies and other things, out of our Russia program, I've brought about 9 copies with me, 10 copies, is an action guide that we developed in our Russia program for companies on how to deal with specific types of corruption. So they look at specific cases and then suggest remedies for it. Thank you.
Great job, Andrew. Thanks very much. David, the floor is yours.
Well, Andrew gave me a good lead-in, so I guess I'm here to deal with the sand at the bottom of the system with the judicial issues of enforcement and implementation. Just give you a quick sense of what the bank has been doing in this region. There are myself and a few colleagues, we've been working directly with loans to the a number of governments directed specifically at reforming judicial systems. We've completed projects in Georgia, Armenia, Albania, and Russia, and have ongoing projects in a second one in Armenia and Russia, Macedonia, and Azerbaijan. And we have projects in the pipeline now in Serbia and Croatia. So we're working. These are countries that have been, that have taken on at least the responsibility and the desire for reform, and enough that they're borrowing money for it, and working with us on a number in a number of areas to improve the judicial system. In addition to that, we've done some assessments and reviews of the state of the judicial system in a number of countries. As a precursor to the work in Macedonia, I led a team that did an assessment on essentially the judicial system as an impediment to business investment in Macedonia, which led to this investment project now that we're working on. And we've also done a regional study a couple of years ago, which I made available to you here. Hopefully some of you have picked up, and I'll show some data from that, which tried to look at, I guess it, in 2005, at the available data as to kind of essentially how far had the region come in addressing the problems of the judicial systems in the countries. We see some improvement was the general conclusion, but a long way to go, as you've heard already from the earlier speakers. And lastly, we have a number of ongoing policy dialogues with countries, both some of the new EU member states and those in Central Asia and elsewhere, on the whole range of issues dealing with judicial reform. I think you've heard why we should look at judicial reform. I think from the prior speakers have mentioned the role that the courts play in enforcing regulations, enforcing the new laws. Ultimately, you end up in court if there are violations or questions as to what the law means. And the question then becomes, how well are those courts functioning? How well do they know and understand the new laws and the new principles? The data I have, I'm going to show you, I am expanding the focus a little bit to include specific data on Croatia and Macedonia. I think because they're the next two in line. In general, that's one reason. Another reason is I've been working in Macedonia for about 4 years, so I have a little, just to give you a disclaimer, but I do have a bit of a stake in seeing some improvements there and hopefully some economic results because of those improvements. I don't know if I'll get evaluated on their growth, but it certainly would be comforting after traveling there so many times to see some changes. We're using these off space. Okay. The bank conducts a study of businesses throughout the region, which is we affectionately call the BEEPS survey, which is the Business Environment and Enterprise Performance Survey. I'm not responsible for the title. But it produces a wealth of information, which is analyzed in a number of different ways in the bank. And when we did the regional study, we started to look more deeply at a number of the questions that were asked about the judicial system. One of the key questions that the survey asks is lists a number of areas and asks whether these are a problem for doing business. And these are small and medium enterprises, large enterprises. I don't remember the breakdown between foreign and domestic. I think primarily domestic firms are questioned. The data I'm going to use this afternoon is from 2002 and 2005 surveys. The 2008 survey is ongoing, and results will be hopefully the end of the year or the beginning of 2009. And what you see here is that at the far side, we've grouped together the EU8, the first new member states into the EU, and that's really the only group that has shown some improvement, where it's gone down from a little bit above 40% to a little bit above 30% of the firms have identified the operations of the judicial system, the functioning of the judicial system, as an actual hindrance to their doing business. You see that Macedonia and Croatia, the two countries that are still in line for accession, you have firms showing greater problems. And at least in Croatia, it's pretty much been the same over those period of time. And in Macedonia, it got worse. With Bulgaria, I actually think that in 2008, we'll probably see the bar go back up a bit. I'm a little surprised that there was an improvement in 2002 and 2005. I'm not so sure there were things on the ground to justify that. These are perceptions of firms, so we deal with the perception data because of that. As I mentioned before, in Macedonia and Croatia, we have projects or are developing projects. So I think one of the things that these surveys and all this data points out is that, and as we've heard already from the doing business and TI data that you've seen, is that countries are recognizing where they stand and where the problems are and are asking for help. In addition, we have a very large ongoing project in Romania and have just completed an initial study on judicial budgeting and beginning work with the Bulgarians on these issues. So the fact that these problems are cropping up both in the previously acceded countries, the new accession countries, and those in line have really heightened the interest in getting more involved in reforming the judicial system. Though I do have to say, as I think Andrew pointed out, reforms and the laws were easy. Reforms in some of the regulatory institutions were the next step. And the poor stepchild has always been the judicial system. And what countries are now realizing is that it's becoming an obstacle to further growth and further investment. This just to pick up on the Andrew's presentation on corruption, one of the questions that's asked is, do you think the courts are honest and uncorrupt, put in a positive way? Unfortunately, only one country kind of which is Estonia, gives a more or less positive response to that. You've got three countries that are approaching 50%, but that's still telling you that slightly over 50% of the firms are saying they feel the court system is corrupt. And in fact, most of the countries are closer to the 25% range here. This creates it's a major constraint in using the court system if you don't trust it. This then builds into business decisions, where you look for alternatives to going to court to resolve your disputes. In many of these countries, there aren't any legitimate or legal alternatives. The development of alternative dispute resolution methods lags behind the court system in many places, though I have to say that our colleagues at the IFC have been working quite hard in the Balkans and other places to improve that. So you end up with you know, in economic terms, economically inefficient methods, strong-arm methods, use of corrupt methods to enforce contracts and to deal with, you know, with debtors that aren't paying. In addition, you end up with limiting growth because firms don't trust the court system and they'll only work with those clients and suppliers that they can trust. So you narrow your potential for business investment and for growth. Now, again, this is 2005 data. I think that as we saw in the TI numbers and in general, I'm certainly hopeful that in a number of these areas in the 2008 data, we will see some marked improvements and get at least certainly a few more of the countries above the 50% line. But it is a long way to go. It is an inherent problem, and I would argue it goes beyond, you know, whether judges are paid a proper salary and clerks are paid a proper salary. And there's a culture that has been built up here that needs to be broken, and that takes time. And I also wanted to give a plug just for another publication. The bank has analyzed the BEEPS data over the three terms of surveys, and this was the most recent one, Anti-Corruption in Transition 3. I don't know whether there's going to be a fourth one or not with the 2008 data, but all of this information and a lot of the data is manipulable, like the doing business data, is on the bank's website and available for you to look at. Okay. The initial reforms in the region and judicial reforms really focused on independence. As these countries became independent, the issue was, well, we need to have an independent judiciary. How do we do that? Change constitutions, perhaps improve the way we appoint some of the higher court judges, Supreme Court judges, constitutional court judges. Really, a lot of the early reforms ended there, stopped there. They didn't go much deeper. And what we see is that the efficiency and effectiveness of the court system were not really a focus in the early years of reform. So what this chart shows, I think, probably most drastically and dramatically is when you ask firms whether they think the court system is fast, I mean, the conclusion across the board is no. Interestingly, even the EU8 countries, and this is all 2005 data, were quite low. We have comparators in 2005 for some Western European countries. To be honest, they didn't do a whole heck of a lot better. Speed and efficiency in the court systems is an issue. I think it's an issue in the United States. I mean, at least, among businessmen, decisions aren't being made quick enough. The other area where we see a little better situation but still problems is the ability to enforce a judgment. Just like passing a law has to be implemented, once the judge reaches a decision, it has to be enforced. And in many places, we've identified this as another logjam, another obstacle towards an effective and efficient judicial system. There have been some improvements here. There have been changes in Western Europe in the last decade in the enforcement of judges, moving to a private bailiff system, taking the enforcement process out of courts and moving it to an administrative practice. Secondly, even moving it out of a public institution into a private institution. The Dutch were the most recent to do this, I believe, in Western Europe. Bulgaria implemented it, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, and Macedonia last year. And I can tell you, in Macedonia, it's had a dramatic change in the percentage went from kind of 2 or 3, which is terrible, to 27 or 30, which isn't great. It's still better. But when you talk to businesses, the change in attitude has really been incredible. Businesses don't view it as a problem anymore. They understand they go into a business with a completed judgment, and there's a process, and it'll get enforced. At least that's the perception. And again, in many cases, and I think in this case, perception is reality. The businesses feel it'll be enforced. You start to build up more trust in the system, and you use the court system more to resolve disputes. Speed and the quickness of the procedures, we're working in a number of countries on procedural changes to decrease the number of procedures, increase the efficiency of the procedures in the courts. There's also efforts in just about all of the work that we're doing to automate the judicial system. Again, the judiciary is the last one to get computers, the last one to understand how to use them even when they get them, and trying to automate the management systems there. But one of the key bottlenecks here has nothing to do with laws and nothing to do with IT. It has to do with the culture. In many countries, there are provisions that allow judges to manage their trials and their courts, and they just don't use them. And in some sense, the judges feel it's not fair. In other situations, I think the judges just aren't used to having that authority and that power, and won't use them. We're looking, I think, at in some cases, a generational issue here as you improve the training and the practice for new judges. Perhaps we'll see some changes. But there's been a lot of requests for IT and automation when you're automating a system that just brings things faster to a stop. The paper gets to the judge, but if the judge gets into court and lets the lawyers delay, continues hearings over and over again, doesn't penalize for not showing up in court when they have these powers, the practices won't change. And again, this is a more difficult problem to address, and a longer-term problem to address. The study that we did was in 2005, and it used earlier data. We didn't actually have the 2005 BEEPS data, so this chart may look a little bit different than from what's in the booklet. This has been updated to include our 2005 data. And what you have here on the horizontal axis is the log of GDP per capita, essentially a proxy for measuring what types of resources are available to provide judicial services. Clearly, if countries are poorer, there are many competing priorities, and providing additional resources to the judiciary may not be very high. The vertical axis shows what we call kind of demand for judicial services, and it's an average of the percent of firms that have been to court and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development's transition indicators, kind of how far the countries are along in the transition process. What's interesting here is we tried to kind of identify groups of countries, and they really group themselves once you plot the data, so that in the upper right-hand corner you have all the countries that we've been discussing this afternoon, where you have available resources, economies have been growing, capacity seems to be there to deliver judicial services, but because of the increased economic activity, you also have a much greater demand on the systems. The businesses are more sophisticated, they expect more sophisticated judges. One interesting feature that when we tracked this data against the first chart I showed you of the problems of doing business, is that where you saw greater demand and good to great capacity, you also saw more complaints. And it's essentially rising expectations. People expect more out of the system. The systems, again, are slower to reform than the economies in general are, so people are complaining about the judicial system. And that's really what we found. Bulgaria and Romania, as you see, are kind of medium as far as resources. Again, this is in 2005. But they had reached the point where the demand was very high. So you're going to find the greatest complaints in countries like that. And again, we're dealing with perceptions here. The actual systems may not be any worse. And as you saw, I think in some cases, Bulgaria and Romania were about average to the other EU8. But firms will find more problems because they expect more out of them. And the demand, the number of cases is growing. In some cases, you just don't have the court facilities to handle that. You don't have the number of judges to handle it, and so on. The Macedonia appears kind of in the middle there, where, again, it's struggling with both resources and growing demand. But I think to their benefit, 2 years ago they recognized this and really asked both USAID and the World Bank for assistance and have developed a strategy to move forward with the reforms. I just want to quickly break down some of the doing business data that Svetlana talked about. This just shows you kind of the fact that there's been very little change in one category that doing business looks like, which is the ability to enforce contracts. Poland and Macedonia have the greatest changes between, I think this was 2005 and 2007. We looked at otherwise, it's a slower process to reform, What you also see is that even countries that have been in the EU longer and are better reformers in other areas, like Slovenia, are actually have the longest amount of time it takes to get a contract dispute resolved. And in the doing business example here, this is kind of a simple debt contract based on, I think, the average salaries, certain number of of salaries, and they look at kind of the standard procedures in the capital city to resolve this type of a dispute. So they try to standardize it as much as possible. Here we break it down to see where in the process the delays are, and it looks like most of it is in the trial stage. As I just said, it's partly procedures, partly lack of automation, but I would argue a large part of it is this harder to crack nut of culture. Enforcement is in green. It's also 20% or so of the time, and I think that's an area which these institutional changes can attack more quickly and better once they make the political decision to make the changes. And just to give you some European context, you've got Germany, the Netherlands, Greece, and Italy as the global rank when it comes to enforcing contracts. This includes number of procedures, days, and cost. So you've got all the three characteristics together. So I just wanted to end on I don't know if it's ending on a positive note or not, but putting it into context within Europe, the Central European countries aren't the worst within Europe. They aren't, and in fact, in some cases, they're the best in some of the countries. But I think this isn't the only area where, because of the accession process, the reformers and the ones that take it seriously have actually jumped the Western European countries who have been able to backslide, let's put it, in some areas.
Okay. That's it?
Yeah.
Great. Thanks very much, David. Thanks to both of you. And let's open up for questions. Let's make about 10 minutes so Roman has enough time, and if there's time left, then we can field further questions. So, Sally?
Salim, when Bulgaria and Romania were asked to join the European Union, the EU took the unprecedented step of putting in the safeguard clause for precisely this reason. There will be a report coming up at the end of June, and there's been a lot of conversation and consternation about what's going to happen and will they actually invoke. Do you have either speaker, I'd be interested if they have any sense of whether that is going to happen or will it just be another report?
Well, now you're going to get my personal view, I think. I'm not working in either Bulgaria or Romania. I have colleagues that are working there. I think they will not invoke a penalty per se, mainly because they haven't done it before. I'm not sure this is going to be the first step. I don't think those reports will be positive, or if I can put it in a positive way, I think the reports will be negative. I think they'll identify areas where there's been improvement, where there's been, you know, changes in laws, institutions, perhaps better training. Both countries have actively been working both with the bank and other donors and grantor and the EU to make changes. But, you know, as we've heard in the Bulgaria example in particular, I mean, the organized crime and the violence, I don't think that's gone down at all. There hasn't been any measures to show that's gone down. So I think the reports will be negative, but I'd be personally surprised if there were sanctions of some sort.
I agree. I don't think you're probably going to see sanctions. Concern, wrist slapping, but I don't think they would take the step of actually imposing anything.
Say keeping them under the watchful eye is in one sense a sanction. I mean, I don't think it's going to be removed either. I don't think they've got to that point.
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. To what extent has the internet helped in getting more transparency?
I would say in a couple of ways. I think the most important thing is where governments have gone into e-government, and information has become more easily accessible. You know, that's a real important point for business people. And I remember, you know, both the ability for people to access it, but the quality of information that gets put out by government. And we've seen moves in many countries, not just with the internet, but in general, to improve access to information and freedom of information within societies. I would just draw attention to a study that we sponsored in Georgia some years ago, which looked at how businesses accessed information. And really, this was prior to e-government really taking hold in a lot of these places. And what we did was our partner took a look at the Georgian Information Act, and they went out to 20 different ministries and requested information. This is off the top of my head, so the numbers are illustrative. So they go to 20 different ministries and ask just for general information. They got information back from about 12 or 13 of those ministries to the level that they wanted it. Five or six gave them partial information, and one or two, notably the Interior Ministry, refused to provide information. So when they went back to the ministries to say, well, why wasn't the information forthcoming? Those that couldn't comply or partially complied largely said they didn't have the resources to do so, whether it was human or cash. So, you know, the information wasn't making it out to the public in the first place. They then turned around and looked at the business community to try and understand how the business community was going to access information. And they found that if you were a large company, it was no problem. You had lawyers on staff. It was very easy for you to go out and track changes in laws and regulations and to keep abreast of things. If you were a medium-sized or small company that was a member of a business association or a chamber of commerce, you tended to get your information through those organizations or intermediaries. But if you were a small business and you were not a member of an association or chamber, you were out there on your own, and those are usually the ones that are most susceptible to bribery. Because, you know, rather than try to figure out how to comply or what the steps are for complying, it's much easier just to pay a bribe. So when you talk about the power of the Internet, actually having regulation accessible for somebody from their desktop is a very powerful tool to help people comply with the law. And a lot of the efforts we've done around Russia and around the former Soviet Union have been towards trying to improve access to information.
Hi, Leonard Oberlander. Because of the nature of corruption and some opaqueness, is there less of an incentive for out-of-court settlements? Do they pretty much not exist because of either a bribe or a judicial decision?
Well, I'll let you talk about your experience, but I would say it certainly has been a practice in the past as far as government regulation of companies go. If you want to avoid prosecution or that sort of thing, you know, pay the bribe and get it out of the way. Where you're talking about company to company or private to private corruption, you know, the trend really has been, rather than to try and take it into shadows, is to try it and try to take it into someplace where there's light. So if a foreign company is going into a market, they're agreeing within the contract that if they have disputes, they're going to be settled in London, someplace where you can trust the court system. So, you know, that's being the trend. You work around the system rather than try to under it.
As I said, I think the ADR area, alternative dispute resolution of mediation, arbitration domestically in these countries, is pretty nascent or immature. If it exists, it's more informal, I think, which is fine, provided it doesn't become strong arming or bribing. That said, of all places, Albania actually took a loan from the bank and invested a portion of it in setting up a private mediation center, arbitration and mediation center. I haven't checked in a year to see how it's been working, but I think countries more and more now, and as I mentioned, IFC has an active program in the Balkans, are trying to build up the domestic capacity to, as Andrew said, bring it into the light and to formalize some system. In almost all of these countries, there is an informal dispute resolution system of some sort. It can be elders. It can be, in some cases, religious. And businessmen have been using things like that, and the cases don't – they don't end up in court. The problem is that how are those enforced? There are a lot of disadvantaged parties, particularly women in many cases, don't get a hearing and get discrimination in those types of forms. So it's an area that if you can regularize it without choking it to death with regulation, that's the balance on a number of the countries are trying to strike now.
Uh,
Okay, I think we'll just move swiftly on to Roman. Okay, last but not least, we have Roman Kupczynski from Radio Free Europe, who for years has extensively monitored Russian business activities throughout Central Eastern Europe. And I think this is just an update, Roman, of some of your findings. Thanks very much.
Good afternoon. I'd like to give an example, or a number of examples, of how official Russia or Kremlin-friendly companies, how they've been conducting business in Central and Eastern Europe, not only Russian-registered companies, but companies that are run by Russians who have very close links to the Kremlin bureaucracy, to the powers that be in Moscow. I'll be talking about the murky side of business dealings where Russian companies are involved. Much of Russian business, of course, with the West is open and transparent. Because it's a Russian company doesn't mean that it's a bad company or a company which is opaque or what. But there are significant sectors where this opaqueness includes a political dimension. The first case deals with Romanian aluminum and Russian gas. How this came together, what took place in Romania in the past few years, with the Romanian aluminum business. In 2006, the Romanian intelligence service, the SRI, prepared a memo claiming that Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska, who, as you know, is very close to the Kremlin, had made an attempt to take over the entire Romanian aluminum industry. This happened at a time when aluminum enterprises in Romania, Alro Slatina, Alprom Slatina, and Alum Tulsia, became slated for privatization during the government of Adrian Năstase. Deripaska failed to win the tenders. Why? It's not been made clear. Deripaska claims that he had no interest at all in the aluminum business and that the Romanian intelligence agency report was wrong. But two companies, Alum Tulsia and Alros Latina, two aluminum companies in Romania, were sold to the Marco Group. The Marco Group was a group that had been founded by Mark Rich, who, as we all know, was pardoned many years ago by former President Jimmy Carter, a rogue, controversial commodities trader. The Marco Group was later acquired by a Russian-Israeli businessman called Vitaly Machitsky. The Romanian SRI memo stated that the Marco Group, owned by Machitsky, also controls a company called Conef Energy SRL, an energy company which acts as an intermediary in the purchase of gas from Gazprom, from the Russian state monopoly Gazprom. Furthermore, the SRI claimed that Machitsky owned 99% of Conef. Naturally, the Romanian intelligence service was very highly concerned that Machitsky not only had gotten control over a significant part of the Romanian aluminum business, but he also apparently controlled a significant amount of Romania's gas imports from Russia. All this within a tightly held, very opaque business group, the Marco Group. In April 2007, how do I go back? Okay. Yeah. Thank you. In April 2007, Gazprom Export, a subsidiary of Gazprom, which is in charge of selling gas to foreign companies. A company is headed by Alexander Medvedev, the deputy CEO of Gazprom, signed a contract with Conef, the Romanian Conef, owned by Mahitsky, who lives in Moscow, to sell Romania up to 2 billion cubic meters of gas annually from 2010 to 2030. The contract, the aggregate supply, would be 42 billion cubic meters of gas within that span of time that the contract is for. But the dealings between Conef and the Marco Group and Gazprom do not appear to be totally innocent or opaque at all. Mahitsky attempted to keep his bid to buy Alro Slatina's secret, hidden behind a web of offshore companies he controlled. His lawyer, a fellow called David Lee Sherman, explained this by saying, and I'll quote from Sherman, "It would be better to negotiate with the Romanian government through a U.S. or Israeli connection rather than a Russian company because of the perceived antipathy of Romanians to Russians." Mahitsky and his former partner, a guy called Alexander Krasner, according to a transcript of the proceedings of the Queen's Bench Division, a commercial court in London, had conceived of a plan drafted by Mahitsky, which they named in Russian the Vostok Plan, or the Eastern Plan. The strategic objective of the Vostok Plan was defined as the creation of a vertically integrated operation that would give the men power over everything from a plant producing raw materials, Alum SA, which Mahitsky's enterprises had already acquired, to a power plant and a plant producing primary products, the company Alro, and to a plant for manufacturing products, Alprom of Romania. The plan outlined the details and the strategy, including lobbying people in high positions of political influence, the heads of consulting banks, and the Romanian state privatization agency. As I said, in April 2007, Gazprom signed a contract with Conef on the gas deal, on long-term gas supplies. The contracts provide and give Gazprom long-term access to shipping facilities in Romania. At the same time, Gazprom also agreed on the side to increase gas deliveries to the Alro Slatina aluminum plant owned by Mahitsky's Marco Group. The price that Gazprom charged Conef for these side deliveries of gas was immediately classified as a commercial secret, and nobody is allowed to know what was going on. So it was obvious there was a conflict of interest going on, but even more important, that the sweetheart deal between Conef, positioned in Romania, had tied the country to a long-term gas contract with Gazprom, which the Romanian government, in fact, did not control, had no say whatsoever over what Mahitsky was doing. So it can be argued to the effect that Romania not only lost control of its sovereign ability to diversify energy supplies, but also surrendered the aluminum sector to businessmen closely but indirectly linked to the Kremlin through Gazprom export. Okay. We'll leave the Romanian questions aside. There are many, many other things one can talk about in terms of opaque activities going on in Romania, but let me turn to a company called Gazprom Germania. Gazprom Germania was set up in Berlin by Gazprom and Gazprom Export to become the hub of an ever-growing number of companies. Gazprom Germania, according to the German magazine, news magazine Stern, quote, has built up for its Moscow bosses a complex network of shareholdings and companies that stretch right across Europe.
Huh? Sabotage.
Yes.
We have the image, don't worry.
4 years ago, I would have been able to see. So I'm not going to get into the structures of Gazprom Germania. As you can see, it's a huge web of companies which nobody really understands what is going on with these companies. But in late October of last year, the head of Gazprom's, of Germany's gas company, E.ON, Ruhrgas, Bergmann Burkhardt, who's a member, the only Westerner on the Gazprom board of directors, said that Gazprom Germania, as well as another company, Rosuker Energo, should be removed from their roles as middlemen in the gas business. Bergmann Burkhardt, who understands the gas business very well, realized that these companies had no role to play. They were an additional burden and a siphon of funds to places that he did not understand where it was going. Also, Gazprom Germania, high-level executives of Gazprom Germania have recently been discovered to have been former Stasi agents who did not report the fact that they had worked for the Stasi in the DDR at the time. Why were they put in by Gazprom? Why did Gazprom go out of its way to hire former Stasi people? Well, the reason was, of course, that the person who controlled Gazprom, Vladimir Putin, the prime minister today, was himself a KGB agent. He had brought in people into Dresdner Bank who had been former Stasi employees, into Gazprom Germania, and you will see eventually, as we go on, that many of these companies were run like intelligence operations, like special operations run by intelligence services. So now we come to a different, complete different web of companies called the Centrex companies. The Centrex companies were created in Austria, in Vienna, in 2003. The Centrex group was created. The mother companies, so to speak, is Centrex Europe Energy and Gas, headquartered in Vienna. But when you look at the chart later on, you want to see where Centrex, who owns Centrex. It comes down to a company in Cyprus called Syrtia Ventures. Syrtia Ventures, further on, is owned by a company in Moscow called OOO Rubin, a closed shareholding company. I had never heard of Rubin when I got this information. I asked somebody in Moscow to go to the address that Rubin had listed in Moscow. So people go, it's an apartment building. No Rubin is listed. Elderly ladies with little puppies, little dogs walk around and what, but there is no Rubin company. Eventually, going through Russian business registry documents and Rubin, you see how Rubin then branches out. And I've talked to friends who understand money laundering. They claim that this is a classic money laundering operation. When you look at the website of the Centrex companies, of Centrex Europe Energy and Gas and all the others, nowhere is it mentioned that Centrex has any relationship whatsoever to Gazprom. Gazprom has never mentioned it at all. It says on one website, the Centrex website, claims Centrex is an international group of companies operating in the natural gas sector, focusing on the extraction and marketing of natural gas reserves in Central Asia. The Centrex group is also involved in the development of sustainable gas production, blah, 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 blah. Now, In 2005, 2 years after the Centrex group had been formed, a report by the European Commission stated that Centrex had privileged access to competitive gas sources through its cooperation with Gazprom. In particular, this European Commission report states, and I quote, Centrex executives claim to have close personal relationships with Gazprom executives. Close personal relationships. They're drinking buddies. They sit somewhere in an alley in Moscow putting away the vodka. This is the way it's sort of meant to look like. However, to complicate things even further, Centrix, the parent company, the Viennese Centrix, was created primarily through the work of a guy called an Austrian lawyer, Hans Baumgartner. Baumgartner had bought a company called Euromax Energy and Gas Development and turned it into Centrix, along with two other Austrian or Swiss nationals, and registered the company in Zug, Switzerland, initially. If you follow Hans Baumgartner's career, eventually in 2004, he winds up as a member of the board of directors of another very strange company called Ross Uker Energo. So the same people, and you, if you go through all these documents, and I spent months going through these documents of the Centrix companies in Gazprom, Germania, you see the same players over and over again appearing in one company, another company, and then we go down to, okay, I'll spare you all the other little details, but let me go into one of the Centrix company schemes. This is one of the ones that I found the most sort of enlightening. It's in May 2005, the Italian energy gas company, Eni, signed an agreement which would have allowed Gazprom Export to participate in selling Russian gas on the Italian domestic market. Immediately, that contract came under investigation by a commission of the Italian Parliament. Why? The commission discovered that a Viennese company called Centrix Energy Italia, Centrix Energy Italian Gas Holdings, was to play a major role in this very lucrative contract. So one of the Centrix companies, the Central Energy Italian company in Vienna. Why would a company in Vienna want to sell gas on the Italian domestic market? Who knows? The investigation further revealed that a prominent Italian businessman named Bruno Mentasti Granelli, known to be a close friend of Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, owned 33% of Central Energy Italian through two companies, Hexagon Primo and Hexagon Seconda, both registered at the same address in Milan. So, Gazprom owned 25% of the shares of Central Energy Italia, whatever, through another company called ZMB, a German registered subsidiary of Gazprom Export, and then the Viennese Centrix Europe Energy held 41%. So you can see it all in one thing coming together, how these corrupt schemes were going. Yeah. How do we get to Berlusconi? Well, we give him a cut. We do it through his friend, through Hexagon 1 and Hexagon 2. The deal fell through. The contract eventually fell through. And Alexei Miller, Gazprom's chief executive officer, and Paolo Scaroni, Eni's chief executive, said that they agreed that we have to remake the contract. but we have to consider various other alternatives how to do this. I think you see where I'm going with this. These are the Centrix companies. You take these and you take the Gazprom Germania companies and you put them together, you see what kind of a web has been created since the election of Putin, since his first election, how this thing has grown out of proportion already. And when you look closely, Gazprom is not always a full-time owner of these things. They might own 50%, they might own 17% of these various companies. The main role, however, and this is was played up to now by Gazprom Export. Now, I mentioned to you a few times about this company, Ross Uker Energo. It's a very long and complicated and very dirty story. But let me just give you an idea of the ownership structure, putting aside the criminal elements, the link to organized crime in Ross Uker Energo, but the organizational structure from the Russian side, from the Gazprom bank side, which owned 50% of Ross Uker Energo, through a company called A. Ross Gas Holdings, Aros Gas Holdings was in turn owned by Syrtia Ventures, the one that owns Centrex in Cyprus, all the way down to our anonymous Rubin company in Moscow. It's the same structure was used for this company as it was used for the Centrex companies. Hundreds of millions of dollars were being, in my view, washed through these arrangements and continue to be washed through these arrangements. Oh, good. What the danger that I see here is that the opaqueness of all these transactions, of this whole network of companies run by the same individuals, in fact, and there's one of them in the United States now, just if you want, if you're interested, it was registered in Houston, Texas a few months ago. It's not only a danger to Central and Eastern Europe energy security or Eastern Europe and Central Asia's energy insecurities. All these front companies are steadily creating new bonds between the Kremlin and companies friendly or terrified of its power. And what is going on is the push is to bring Central and Eastern Europe closer to Moscow's orbit so that the Putin-Medvedev plan to extend Russian economic hegemony, not only political, but also economic hegemony in Western Europe. So their plans become irreversible. Now, I don't believe... I believe they're going to fail in the long run. I don't think it's going to happen quite that simply. I mean, they have huge amounts of money that they at their disposal. I mean, look, and it's not only Russian companies. There's an example today of a Kazakh company coming into Romania to mine for gold. As we saw, Kazakhstan is sort of on the bottom of the list. And here this company from Kazakhstan comes into Romania and immediately gets a privileged play from everybody to get its license to do what it wants. Other companies are forbidden from doing this for unknown reasons. So I don't believe this is going to change, this scheme is going to change under Dmitry Medvedev, the new president. If you look at his appointments, who he has brought in to into the Kremlin now, these are people who have been involved in these same schemes for over the last 5-6 years. So I don't really see any major changes in the next year or so. If Medvedev decides to arrest Putin next year and lock him up for non-payment of taxes, for example, then it's a different story. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks very much, Roman. Open up to questions, comments, clarifications, further details, Sally. Oh, sorry.
Curious to see if you've seen similar situations in other industries. You've spoken about energy and extractive industries. I'm just wondering if there's similar penetration in other places.
Petrochemicals. Chemical industry is a big thing. The Hungarians, for example. The stuff that was going on in Hungary around Borsodskem was just amazing, how Gazprom was making secret deals with the Austrian company OMV to buy, secretly to buy, Borsodskem. Company involved in that whole transaction is called Austrian Capital Partners, ACP. Very mysterious company. You don't know who's behind it. But it's allegedly, and it seemed that way, that it's a number of Russian oligarchs who sort of pooled their money to get into various outfits. This the same company, Austrian Capital Partners, was involved in a different deal to buy Rompetrol, I think it's the name, the Romanian oil company. Yeah? Yeah. Which eventually was sold, and it wound up partially in the hands of a fellow who was involved in petrochemicals, a guy called Jakub Goldovsky, who lives in Vienna, who was the former head of Sibur, a major Russian petrochemical company, who in 2001 wound up in jail for a few months, then got out of jail, fled the country along with some of his associates, and they went, started going after the Hungarian companies in league with Gazprom. Well, that's happening. I mean, Hungary seems to be a big target for a lot of these things. A company in Budapest, Enfes, KFT, which is connected to Rosica Energo, has taken a major role on the Hungarian domestic gas distribution and power market. The problem with Enfes Gas is that its owner, Ukrainian Dmitry Firtash, is allegedly involved with organized crime, with Russian organized criminals, specifically with this fellow, Seva, Semyon Mogilevich. He's presently living in a Moscow jail for the time being. And Hungary has become, in many ways, a lot of people are very upset with what the Russians are doing in Hungary, or Russian proxies. In the Czech Republic, you see a lot of hotel takeovers by Russian mobsters. And not only mobsters, by pretty influential people buying out most of Karlovy Vary. The Czechs are very upset with this. It's a good business. I mean, it's health spas. We should all go there once a year, you know, just relax and drink the disgusting water they pass off as being healthy for you. It might be going on probably in Bulgaria, but I haven't followed it that closely, to be honest with you.
Roman, Bill, go ahead.
Just one quick question, dealing specifically with the energy, the gas issues. Why do you think the EU has not taken a more activist approach in trying to put some rules and regulations into place to stop this encroachment?
Primarily because they don't have a united line. It's each man for himself right now. They've not been able to come to a common denominator. The Germans are insisting that the Nord Stream pipeline be built. It's not clear to me if the Nord Stream pipeline will ever be built. There are tremendous problems in that respect. The Italians are playing their own game at this, supporting South Stream. Turkey has ambitions to be a major gas hub, as does Budapest and as does Austria. They would like to be these gas hubs for the future. At the same time, I don't believe that Russia's share of European gas is going to be rising that much in the future. People say it's going to rise up to over 30%, 35%. I don't believe that. Why? First of all, Russian domestic demand is growing at a much faster rate than they ever expected. I saw some of the internal Gazprom documents, their projections 2020 and 2030 for domestic use in Russia, they were way off. They were using old Soviet statistics from the 1980s to base their projections on. Total nonsense. Second problem is, for years they neglected putting money into new production facilities. Third, the new production facilities are in very remote places, many of them. As well. Another problem which is going to become very important, the Russian Federation was counting heavily on importing Central Asian gas to make up for the shortfall so they can continue exporting the same quantities that they had been contracted to. But they needed the Central Asian gas for their domestic to make up for the domestic shortfalls. Central Asians today are going to be selling to China. The Turkmen-Chinese gas pipeline is being built right now. Right now, the capacity, I believe, is like 30 billion cubic meters a year. The old Central Asian center gas pipeline is falling apart. Dire need of repairs, and it will have to be reconstructed somehow, or a second stream built next to a second string. So that's a problem. But like I said, the Europeans are not united. Everybody's making a separate deal with the Russians. There's no unanimity in the EU. I mean, the whole question of which has fallen by the wayside in the last 2 years of the energy charter. Nobody talks about that anymore. That's a dead issue. Right? That's gone.
Roman, could you indicate what impact all this has on U.S. business, particularly in the Central East European region? In other words, all the, let's say, sometimes privileged access or opaque access that Russian business has in the region?
Well, Russia doesn't have a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. If anything, they have an incorrupt or an opaque business practice act that everybody follows. So that puts the United States immediately at a disadvantage in these areas. I think business people officially will tell you, yeah, well, this is a very good thing, the foreign corrupt. Privately, the feeling is a little different. Because they see that they're losing their advantage in these countries, in these regions, and it's a difficult thing for them to do. If they were playing on a level playing ground, it would be different. But Gazprom, for example, has been looking to list on the New York Stock Exchange. There have been a number of meetings in New York with the exchange to list Gazprom. Now, the New York Stock Exchange would love to list Gazprom. Believe me, for them it would be the greatest thing in the world. Gazprom wants to be there because the capitalization will continue to increase. I think it's the third largest capitalized company in the world today. But my question is, the New York Stock Exchange has very strict rules in terms of corporate governance and what, in order to allow a company to be listed. Now, are they going to lift these rules for Gazprom or somehow, get them through these things without too much problem? Is very problematic. I don't know. If they do, it's going to be a very bad sign. For other companies that would like to get in. The United States, in about 5 years from now, will be depending more and more upon deliveries of liquefied natural gas. Gazprom is trying to get into this business and would love to have 25% of the U.S. LNG market in 5 years from now. That's what they've said officially. How this is going to work, and there is competition. There's a lot of competition in the LNG market. You have Algeria, you have Qatar, you have whatever. U.S. companies are going to be coming face to face with these problems more and more so, in not only dealing in Russia, but in Central Europe, Eastern Europe, and eventually here in the United States, with companies that, at times, operate in a very opaque fashion. That's why it was very strange for me to see that one of the Centrix companies already has opened a branch in Houston.
Please.
Yeah, I,
I feel like I have to say this at this point. I've had this discussion with several people in the past, and usually the response is, yes, I agree. So I'll say this. It's a way of looking at what you've just been describing. In Russia, in the state capitalist system, you have the same individuals as the corporate executives and government officials, and you described it very well. In European countries, as well as in the United States, we have a constitutional separation protecting federal government from undue influence by corporate money and protection for the corporations from undue influence by the federal government, with the exception of reasonable regulations that are necessary. Now, you have, when it's a government-to-government dialogue, it's the same person who's having a government or a private corporation discussion with a Western private corporation. For example, in the last meeting, big economic conference in St. Petersburg, where President Putin participated, he met privately aboard the yacht with American corporate executives, and they were asked by him to help with the globalization process and business deals, and to come back and help persuade the Congress and the administration to be cooperative with these deals. He didn't talk to the government representatives. There was one government representative present there, but I don't think she was on the yacht with the private executives. These were private meetings. That was a trade representative, Susan Schwab. Now, when you think about this, Russia has a distinct advantage and leverage because they can negotiate with the government on the one hand, and then they can negotiate with our private corporations on the other, who then not only negotiate with the government in lobbying, but also retain law firms and public relations firms to address legal issues and issues of public persuasion. It seems like it's a significant advantage. And I was surprised when you said Centrex a few months ago incorporated in Houston, because there's a similar pattern. Gazprom USA incorporated in Houston, incorporated in Delaware. They registered in Houston since 2005. And they're using all of the legal resources available, lobbying, law firms, public relations firms, dealing with state and local governments. And their business plan also is linked not to aluminum here, but to steel. Made steel acquisitions that have been made in the last few years that amount to over 10%, and more now since Sparrow's Point, but more than 10% of United States steel production. So the wheels keep turning. I'm interested in your view of that, the leverage they have by having the same individuals dealing separately with corporate executives and separately with our government officials.
A few days ago, Russian newspaper Vedomosti published an article saying that Alexei Miller, chairman of Gazprom, drew a salary not only as the CEO of Gazprom, but as acting chairman of the board of directors of Gazprom, he earned $2 million. Okay. The previous deputy prime minister of Russia was Dmitry Medvedev, who at the same time was the head of the board of Gazprom. So Dmitry Medvedev was earning about $2.5 million a year as a deputy prime minister from a firm that's registered on the London Stock Exchange as well. I could see the Department of Commerce, Secretary of Commerce in the United States getting money from Shell, $2.5 million a year or so. This a jail cell would open immediately. Yeah. welcome home guy. Yeah. The linkage in Russia between corruption, government, and crime is very tight. You're saying about the leverage they have in the United States, that they could use business executives. They've hired numerous PR firms. Gazprom has hired, Russia has hired, to clean up its image and what. And they'll use it. I mean, for them, that's extremely important. I mean, even here in Washington, when you look, you know, where the money, who's donating money to some of the think tanks in Washington? Not to CSIS, God forbid. But when you go through some of these papers, and it's incredible how much money is going into think tanks from Russia, from Russian companies.
You never approached
us. I'll make a call. So, I mean, it's going to be a full-out offensive. I mean, at times, you know, everybody wants to influence. Inherently, it's not a bad thing. I mean, you want to get a contract, fine. You go out and you talk to people. It gets worse when it becomes sleazy, when the sleaze factor takes over. Should it be combated? I don't know. I mean, I'd combat whatever is illegal, if anything shows out to be illegal. But if it's a major effort to lobby, you know, the Congress or, you know, well, that's, you know, that's democracy, I guess.
Okay, Roman, thank you very much. Again, great job, and you have enough material for several days of conference, I know, but we'll leave that to another day as well. Thank you. Any last comments, Bill? In fact, if anybody else has any comments, please feel free.
No, one recurring theme throughout a lot of the discussion was the need for increased transparency and availability of information, whether it's ownership structures, which are very interesting to find out about because most people are not aware of it, as well as access to rules and regulations. So I think that is something which we should stress in talking with our colleagues.
Yeah, let me just say, in concluding, I think it's been a very useful session. We've had some valuable papers, presentations. I think it may be useful to do to develop a checklist of potential risks and potential solutions, and I've started listing various things. I'm looking forward to this guidebook, the World Bank guidebook on corruption. Secondly, a lot of this material today will be available on our website for those of you that, you know, this sort of floated by on the big screen. And thirdly, we hope to develop this mini-series into something a bit bigger, by not only expanding the agenda, but maybe intensifying, bringing some people from Europe, getting different perspectives from different countries, as well as independent analysts on this question, as well as from U.S. business. So, watch this space, and we'll let you know how things develop. If we get money from Gazprom, we'll certainly... Well, actually, then we won't let you know, will we? But anyway, thanks all for coming, and we'll talk soon.